Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a somewhat invidious job to introduce the director in his own school. Perhaps it was because I'm retired and no longer really a member of the school that I got tapped to do this. But I thought that I really couldn't introduce the director to his own people. So I thought that I would use him as Exhibit A in the case that I want to make against human cloning. Now, the reason I want to do that, and the reason I think this case can be made, is that Howard has done a huge number of things in his life. He's been special advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, controller of the Audit Commission, director general of the CBI, deputy governor of the Bank of England, chairman of the Financial Services Authority, and now director of the London School of Economics. Now, if there was human cloning, he could have done all these simultaneously, whereas since there was only one of them, he had to do it consecutively. Actually, I sometimes think that Howard has got such speed and efficiency of work and such decisiveness that he could possibly have done all these simultaneously. And at the same time have been, and these are what are really important in his life, member of the Barnes Common Cricket Club and the Manchester City Supporters Club. The latter one is possibly a penance rather than anything else, speaking as a Tartan Athletic supporter. Now, if there was human cloning, all the top jobs in the British economy would be held by clones of Howard Davis, and you can imagine all the members of the cabinet and all the senior positions being held in this way, and there'd be no openings for any of the rest of us, and that would make it extremely difficult. It would make those of us who were trying to get decent jobs find that there was an upper barrier filled by Howard Davis A and Howard Davis B and Howard Davis C and so on. And so it is my particular pleasure tonight to be able to introduce the one and only Sir Howard Davis. Over to you.
Thank you, John.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for that introduction. I have to say, though, there is a kind of double invidiousness tonight, if such a thing can be imagined, because Charles is welcoming me to my school, as it were, but I am about to trample all over territory which Charles has in the past made his own. So I'm grateful to him for, as it were, inviting me into this territory of the future of central banking. And we can discuss it tonight, Charles, I hope, and maybe also at Valley Parade on the 4th of December, where I shall be when my team visits Charlton Athletic, which is, as you will be aware, only a few days to go. Now, as Charles said, it happens that I was Deputy Governor of the Bank of England and Chairman of the FSA for 6 years or so. But I ought to say, right at the start, that any coincidence between what I say and the views of either body is entirely accidental. Now, it's conventional to say that since it was granted independence for interest rate setting purposes in 97, the Bank of England has been outstandingly successful. Certainly, it has met its inflation objective without a single letter to the Chancellor of the Exchequer explaining divergence from the target. But in fact, I have to submit to you that Mervyn King has totally failed to meet the principal aim he set for himself and the bank, because he famously proclaimed that our ambition at the Bank of England is to be boring. And if I can start. But I'm afraid that Mervyn has lamentably failed to meet that ambition. It is fair to say, however, that his chosen team, Aston Villa, has recently been remarkably successful in making Premier League football rather dull. But Mervyn's speeches and public pronouncements can never be described as such, and the recent MPC voting, putting the Governor in a minority for the first time, has added further spice to the mixture. On the other side of the Atlantic, in spite of almost 20 years without giving a media interview, Alan Greenspan has remained an object of untiring fascination to Fed watchers around the globe. And now the press can hardly wait for for his successor Ben Bernanke to begin turning down their requests. And in the Eurozone, Governor Fazio of the Bank of Italy has hit the headlines for quite other reasons, another governor who has signally failed the Mervyn King boring test. So central bankers and their activities, or perhaps we should say antics in the Italians' case, remain highly newsworthy. More seriously, though, as the changing of the guard occurs at the Federal Reserve, it is an interesting moment to think about the development of central banking over the last few years and where it might go in the future. And there are particular reasons to do so in Europe, too, as the national central banks of the Eurozone struggle to adapt to life after the establishment of the European Central Bank, or some might say, as they struggle to avoid adapting to life after the establishment of the ECB. Now, I should emphasize that my focus is largely an institutional one, and my frame of reference is more political economy than monetary economics. I shall talk about the political setting within which central banks operate, their institutional structure and governance, and say rather less about the techniques they use to assess monetary conditions and to determine interest rate policies. So anyone who has strayed in here hoping for a top-up class in macro can now make their excuses and leave. Charles himself is preparing a parallel paper on the future of central banking, which will go in more learned detail into the definition of price stability and the global context in which monetary authorities now make their decisions. Now, the first rather banal point to make about central banks, which I think is too infrequently made, is that around the world they differ quite remarkably in functions, size, efficiency, and status. Now, of course, it's usually possible still to recognize a central bank when one sees one. They typically all have grand buildings constructed in a heavy style designed to convey an impression of solidity and safety, architectural stability, one might say. Inside, you will find gilded halls, often decorated, curiously, with crypto-Masonic design features, and usually also nestled among the gold bullion, you will find an extensive, if somewhat old-fashioned, wine cellar. But beyond that, there are many differences. If we look first at the function central banks now perform, then even in the G7 countries, we find a remarkable range of practices. Of the seven central banks in the G7, four have responsibility for monetary policy decisions, while three now do not. If we include the ECB as our eighth G7 bank, then there are five with interest rate setting powers. Of those five, two are responsible for both defining price stability and maintaining it. In other words, they are both target and instrument independent. The other three are target dependent, but instrument independent. And if we look at the other characteristic functions of the central bank, then all seven of the national G7 central banks are lenders of last resort in the sense of providing crisis liquidity support, while the ECB is not. All have some kind of financial stability responsibility, though in some cases it is ill-defined and without a clear statutory basis. In the case of the ECB, it is explicitly enjoined by the treaty to support the financial stability responsibilities of others. Four of the G7 central banks are not the statutory authority for banking supervision. In two cases, Canada and the UK, the central bank plays no role in institutional supervision, while in the other two, Japan and Germany, they still do visit and inspect institutions, albeit for somewhat different purposes in each case. The Bank of Italy, for the time being at least, is the one G7 central bank with full and unambiguous responsibility for banking supervision, including also the responsibility for policing competition in the banking system. It's certainly the only central bank with the latter responsibility, though of course the Italian government would now like to remove it. The Bank of France may be said to be a banking supervisor, although the functions are technically vested in the Commission Bancaire, chaired by the governor. And there are also in France two other statutory agencies with some supervision responsibilities. While in the United States, well, how can I describe the responsibilities for banking supervision in the US without detaining you on the point for the rest of the evening? Perhaps the simplest thing to say is that the Federal Reserve shares the responsibility for banking supervision with a number of other federal and state bodies, some complementary and some, in a sense, competing. As for note issuance, three issue notes in their own name, though only two print them. The Fed issues notes in the US Treasury's name, which are printed by a separate government agency. Three now issue notes in the name of the ECB. And there are other functions too, beyond these three simple ones, where the roles differ: debt management and the provision of banking services in particular. Neither, I would submit, is essential for the conduct of monetary policy. Indeed, in the case of debt management, the British government concluded in 1997 that it was wrong for the monetary authority also to sell debt, and I agree. The institutions differ remarkably, too, in their size, and their relative sizes are not easy to relate to the breadth of their functions. The Economist regularly publishes a schedule of central bankers per 100,000 population. The most recent figures show the UK at between 2 and 3 Bank of England staff per 100,000 people, with Australia and Japan at around 4, the USA around 8, and the euro area at 17, albeit less than a third of the remarkable Russian figure. One might think that since the eurozone should have achieved efficiencies by reducing 12 monetary policies to 1, that some economies of scale would be apparent on this measure, but other factors would appear to be more significant. Like wages and prices, central bank staffing levels are sticky downwards, to coin a phrase. Another attempt has been made by McKinley and Bennion to measure the efficiency of central banks, and even to try to add qualitative measures by looking at achieved inflation rates at the one, on the one hand, and the proportion of bad debts in the banking system on the other, as a kind of proxy for the efficiency of banking supervision. Their conclusions are reported in a recent volume on central bank modernisation. The results seem to me to be rather curious and do not obviously reflect the staffing numbers I've quoted. I wouldn't wish to maintain that the precise rankings here should be given any particular significance. Perhaps the only firm lesson one can draw from these statistics is that operating performance varies remarkably from bank to bank. And there's one further measure on which central banks differ remarkably, which is the pay of their governors. Just the other day, the FT published its own league table of central bank governor salaries, with Alan Greenspan at the bottom of the league on a derisory $180,000 a year, and Jean-Claude Trichet at the top with €585,000, beating Mervyn King into second place. In fact, it may be somewhat misleading, though, to put Trichet at the top of this table, as the FT did, because The Economist reported several years ago that Governor Fazio's salary was somewhere north of $700,000, and the heads of the monetary authorities in Singapore and Hong Kong are certainly paid more. Once again, it's hard to draw firm conclusions from these figures in terms of value for money. Perhaps the figures more closely reflect the approach taken in the different respective countries to the pay of public servants. The one surprising point is that in some countries, such as Spain and Italy, the governor's salary is still undisclosed. So we have to acknowledge from this rather atmospheric survey that there is no identikit central bank on offer which we can take as our reference point. Some of the variations I've quoted, notably governor's salaries, perhaps not particularly serious, but the differences in functions certainly are. However, the picture is not a static one, and there have been a number of trends observable in recent years. And four seem to me to be of particular significance, and together they are changing the landscape in significant ways. The first is the introduction of inflation targets, beginning in New Zealand in 1989, then changes in the organisation of financial regulation in many countries. Third, and to some extent consequent upon that one, the development of new definitions of the central bank's financial stability role. And fourth, the growth of public expectations of central banks, especially in relation to their accountability and transparency. Now, the first sighting of an inflation target was reported in Wellington in New Zealand in 1989. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand Act, introduced by the then Ministry of Finance, Roger Douglas, separated objective setting, which was seen as a role for the government, from interest rate determination, which was seen as a technical matter. According to the RBNZ Act, before the appointment of a new governor, the finance minister and governor must sign an agreement setting out targets for the bank to achieve during the governor's 5-year term. The policy targets must be consistent with the overriding objective of achieving and maintaining stability in the general level of prices. Now, the inflation target regime in New Zealand and the distinction between target and instrument independence proved remarkably effective in practice and soon generated considerable interest among both policymakers and academics. Politicians were attracted by a framework which set out clear accountabilities and gave them some insurance against the risks of a central bank run by, to coin a phrase, inflation nutters. Central bankers themselves and monetary economists, while also attracted by the clear accountabilities, were especially keen on the impact of a credible inflation target on inflation expectations. And a number of countries began to copy elements of the New Zealand regime, and in 97 this alien plant took root in the United Kingdom. Indeed, 22 countries have now adopted inflation targets. The Bank of England Act 88, as it became, incorporated a very rigorous variant of the inflation target framework. With a symmetrical target, a Monetary Policy Committee with independent members, of whom Charles was one of the first, and published minutes, and a formal procedure whereby the governor of the bank must explain the reasons for any deviations of more than 1% around the central rate. And this has been a successful regime for some time. Indeed, the governor recently held a celebration dinner to mark the 100th meeting of the Monetary Policy Committee, to which he kindly invited me, even though I had attended only the first three meetings. And I said, well, was it really fair that I should be there, because I was only there for a very brief period of time. And Mervyn said it was very important that I was there because I performed a very useful function for him, in that whenever he was asked, accused in the press of being a hawk on inflation, as Mervyn sometimes is, he was able to say that there was one member of the Monetary Policy Committee who had voted for a rate rise at every meeting he had ever attended, which was me. Because if you remember in 97, when we took over this regime, the previous government in the run-up to the election had held down interest rates for political reasons, so we were left playing catch-up. And I suspect that this achievement of being the only person to vote at every possible meeting, I suspect is one which is unlikely to be rivaled, since people are now appointed for 3 years, and if they did appoint someone who voted for a rate increase on 36 consecutive occasions, I think they probably would have made a mistake. Now, not everyone has been convinced by the seductive charms of the inflation target. Sam Britton has warned against seeing inflation targetry as the end of history as far as monetary policy is concerned, and prefers a different type of nominal anchor. And neither the ECB nor yet the Federal Reserve have adopted such a framework. Indeed, in his parting address to the Jackson Hole conference this year, Alan Greenspan was once again notably lukewarm about the idea. He said, "To date, we have chosen not to formulate explicit inflation targets, in part out of concern that they could inhibit the effective pursuit of our goal of maximum sustainable economic growth." We must acknowledge, too, that the success of inflation targetry has been achieved against a remarkably benign political and economic background. It has been in what Mervyn King has memorably described as a nice decade, nice standing for non-inflationary, consistently expansionary. We do not yet know how inflation targeting will perform in a more stressful environment. But it seems reasonable to suggest that inflation targeting is now, if you like, the regime to beat. And in Ben Bernanke, Bush has appointed an economist who has written very favorably in the past about inflation target regimes. Indeed, in his testimony before the Senate Banking Committee just 9 days ago, he said, "One possible step toward greater transparency would be for the FOMC to state explicitly the numerical inflation rate or range of inflation rates it considers to be consistent with the goal of long-term price stability, a practice currently employed by many of the world's central banks." It seems likely, therefore, that before long the Fed will become the 23rd inflation targeter. Now, the second major change which has affected the environment for central banks over the last decade has been the gradual, or sometimes dramatic, restructuring of the arrangements for financial regulation and supervision in a number of countries. The most dramatic change has been the establishment in several countries of integrated financial regulators outside the central bank. This development is now frequently associated with the UK, where it was the other half of the great reform package introduced by Gordon Brown in his first week in office in May 97. But in fact, the credit, if that is the right word, should go to the Scandinavians. In Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, integrated regulators were established in the late 80s and early 90s with only a loose relationship with their respective central banks. This model attracted some attention, and indeed a small academic cottage industry of thinking about optimal regulatory structures in the face of changing financial markets began to spring up in the 1990s, and Charles himself inhabited several of these cottages. Perhaps the most comprehensive review of the regulatory structures in a country was carried out by the Australians through the Wallace Commission, which eventually reported in March 97. That commission recommended what had become known as the Twin Peaks model, originally proposed by Michael Taylor, whereby a single prudential regulator handled capital requirements across the financial sector, with a single conduct of business regulator alongside it, both of them outside the central bank. And the intellectual rationale for this approach was well set out by the Wallace Commission. The Australian government accepted the recommendation and set up APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, and ASIC, their Securities and Investments Commission. It's interesting to note, however, that no other country has chosen to adopt such an approach. And there are many question marks about it in Australia today, following the failure of one of their largest insurance companies, HIH, in 2001. And the Royal Commission report, the Australians are still going for Royal Commissions, though we've rather given them up, which followed that collapse, drew attention to some of the drawbacks. The other country that's come nearest to copying this model is the Netherlands, but there the prudential regulator is now part of the central bank. In the UK, no comparable analysis or review was undertaken before the 1997 decision to set up the Financial Services Authority. We can only deduce, after the event, the government's motivations. But they certainly included the desire to create a new structure for the Bank of England, which gave it a single clear objective and removed the risk of reputational damage for the Monetary Authority as the result of difficulties in the financial system. Now, this argument is perhaps disappointing, but I think it's realistic, and it's based on the recognition that whatever the causes of financial failures and scandals, regulators are typically criticised for not having nipped them in the bud earlier. The BCCI case against the Bank of England, thankfully now concluded, but only just concluded, is a striking example of that phenomenon. The other important argument, though, which I suspect was secondary from the government's point of view, was that the financial sector itself was becoming more interdependent, with the growth of financial supermarkets on the one hand, and the development of techniques and instruments which allow risk transference from one type of financial institution to another on the other. So functional or sectoral regulation was no longer obviously well suited to this changed financial sector. A third argument was that one-stop regulation would prove attractive to mobile international firms and would therefore represent a competitive advantage for the City of London. Since the reforms in London, a number of other countries have moved in the same direction, notably Japan and Korea in Asia, and Germany, Belgium, and Austria in Europe, together with some other less well-known examples like Malta, Estonia, and Kazakhstan. Those countries which have made such changes have generally been happy with them, and surveys of market participants typically put single regulators ahead of others in terms of their ability to respond to market changes and to their influence on the attractiveness of the market to mobile financial firms and businesses. A very recent survey, just published 2 weeks ago, confirmed that London's is the regime of choice among the major Western financial centres. Now, it's too soon to draw up a definitive balance sheet of integrated regulation, or indeed, I suppose, of the principle of separating banking supervision from monetary policy and the other central banking functions. But at the very least, the previous easy assumption that a fully-fledged central bank should be responsible for monetary policy and banking supervision has now been robustly challenged. In the Eurozone, the debate about the central bank role in supervision has been particularly charged, no doubt because the national central banks, having lost their direct responsibilities for monetary policy, have been particularly reluctant to see further powers and activities slip away from them. This has produced some unusual changes in policy. Until the introduction of economic and monetary union, the Bundesbank was particularly resistant to taking formal responsibility for banking supervision. Indeed, in the debates leading up to the Maastricht Treaty, the Bank of England argued that the ECB should be given supervision powers, while the Bundesbank was against. As Marjorie Dean and Robert Pringle report in their entertaining study of central banks, while the treaty envisages the possibility of designating the ECB as a competent supervisory authority, that was as far as the Bundesbank were prepared to go towards the Bank of England's way of thinking. Recently, of course, the British and German roles have been reversed. The Bundesbank reacted vigorously in public to the German government's plan to establish a German FSA and supported a doomed attempt by the ECB to make its own banking supervision committee the coordinating body for supervision in the EU, while the Bank of England, by contrast, now seems to be entirely content with its new focused responsibilities and thrilled to have got rid of the responsibility for banking supervision to the FSA. Perhaps it may be argued that for an NCB with no monetary responsibilities, the contagion argument no longer applies. But it would seem that for the Bundesbank and some other national central banks, the need to maintain status and employment were uppermost. German commentators have been particularly caustic about the Bundesbank's struggle for redefinition, describing it unkindly as a shadow of its former self, or indeed as meaningless. There's an interesting and entertaining debate on this, which reviews the evidence on the future role of the Bundesbank in a recent MSc thesis produced in the school. It is not surprising that an institution criticised in this way should attempt to resist further depredations. However, as I shall argue later, these attempts to resist change can be counterproductive and indeed damaging to the reputation of central banking. In an earlier reorganisation of the Bank of England in 1994, Governor Lord George, as he then wasn't, divided the bank into two wings, one with responsibility for monetary stability and the other in charge of financial stability. And at that time, the financial stability wing had a very broad set of interests, including promoting the competitiveness of British financial firms and the attractions of the City of London as a leading financial centre. The then Deputy Governor, Rupert Pennant-Ray, described the financial stability wing as reflecting the interests of, I quote, the bank as paterfamilias to the city. Well, that role is no more. Indeed, this broad definition of the bank's responsibilities in the financial centre was, I think, always hazardous. It is difficult to be both an objective, independent supervisor of financial institutions and also a promoter of their competitiveness and of the vitality of the City of London. We often measure the vitality of the city by the number of banks in the City of London. It would be very easy to increase that number rather remarkably by admitting banks from countries who would love to have incorporated in the Bank of in London on their letterheading, but whose home supervision is completely inadequate and whose capitalisation is extremely weak. So you face a rather dangerous conflict of interest if you are both the flag waver for the City of London and also the supervisor of the banking system. But although the definition of financial stability within the Bank of England has significantly changed in the intervening decade, the term remains in use. And it's one which has proved extraordinarily influential around the world. In a recent paper on defining and achieving financial stability, Bill Allen and Geoffrey Wood of the Cass Business School argue that the bank's use of the term in 1994 was the first coinage of the phrase. Yet it's now one which permeates the academic literature and indeed the publications of central banks around the world. I was personally involved in the launch of the Bank of England's Financial Stability Review in 1996. I've explained elsewhere that one of the motives of that launch was in fact to protect the bank's then position in banking supervision, which was under threat after BCCI and Barings. But although the review was entirely unsuccessful in that context, it has been extensively imitated around the world. And a huge range of central banks now publish their own financial stability reviews, including the French and the Austrians, and I gather this year the People's Bank of China will publish one. The IMF, for good measure, publishes a global financial stability report, which is the kind of capstone for the rest. Yet, as Allen and Wood point out, there is still no widely accepted definition of financial stability, and therefore no consensus on what policies should be pursued in its interests. They argue, rightly in my view, that it's frequently used as a catch-all term to justify interventions across the financial system and indeed to protect the institutional interests of central banks themselves, particularly those which have lost direct responsibility for banking supervision. They argue that a tighter definition of financial stability is required, one which focuses on the risks of damage from financial shocks and institutional failures to innocent bystanders. I rather support that approach, which I've described more fully in a lecture at the IMF meetings in Washington in September. Allen and Wood point out that failure is inherent in the financial system and that it's important not to adopt a definition of financial stability which appears to rule out the possibility of such failure, which could potentially have damaging consequences to the dynamism of the financial system. But whatever the precise definition adopted, I think it's clear that central banks can no longer safely maintain that financial stability is about banking supervision. If they wish to play an important role in new capital markets, they need a broader perspective. In particular, they need to focus on the way in which developments in the financial system as a whole can impinge on the transmission mechanisms of monetary policy. Now, the fourth area of change, which is affecting central banks, along with other public bodies, it must be said, is in the growth of public expectations of accountability and transparency. The nature of these expectations certainly varies from country to country, as does the central bank response. But there's no doubt that a major change has occurred. Whereas a governor of the Bank of England only a decade or so ago could take pride in the fact that most of the workings of the bank were clouded in what he described as decent obscurity, that is certainly not the case today. The changes which have taken place here over the last decade have been dramatic. Governors now appear regularly in front of the Treasury Select Committee, which also carries out what are in effect, if not in name, confirmation hearings. The bank publishes regular inflation and financial stability reports, including forecasts of the expected path of inflation over the next 2 years. The governor speaks regularly in public around the country, and of course, most importantly, the minutes of MPC meetings and the voting records of individual members are published soon after the event. The skirts of the old lady have never been lifted so high. The European Central Bank takes a different tack on voting and on the publication of minutes, though the president does give a press conference after interest rate setting meetings. Remarkably, last week he also gave advance notice of a policy change at the European Banking Congress in Frankfurt. Now, this may seem a significant difference in relation to Bank of England practice, but I think the difference is probably somewhat overstated, as President Trichet argued in remarks he made here at the LSE 2 weeks ago. There are some good reasons for the ECB to operate differently. In circumstances where the Governing Council still incorporates governors from member states, it's easy to see that the publication of individual voting records could be problematic and could lead to individual governors being in effect mandated to vote in a particular way by their governments or indeed by domestic public opinion. Whether that profile of membership of the ECB Governing Council should persist in the long term is a different question to which I shall return. In the US, the accountability mechanisms are somewhat more formal. The chairman delivers his Humphrey Hawkins testimony to Congress twice a year, but otherwise gives no press interviews, or at least that's been the practice in the Greenspan era. We see FOMC minutes, but of a rather different kind to those produced by the MPC here, and individual voting is not revealed. Again, whether that arrangement will survive into the new regime is moot. In these ways, and one could quote other examples, monetary authorities have responded to the need to explain themselves more openly than in the past. And they've typically found that this process of explanation is in turn helpful to the achievement of their objectives. The changing MPC votes here, or the Fed's announcement of its bias, condition market expectations and sometimes help to deliver the desired moderation in price pressure. There is one area, however, where central banks have not changed in the way that other public authorities have done, or should we say where government attitudes to them have not changed, that is in the process of appointment. The procedures for identifying a new pope or a new Dalai Lama are less opaque than those which precede the appointment of a chairman of the Federal Reserve, a governor of the Bank of England, or a president of the ECB. It's striking that in this country, the appointment procedures for most senior public offices have been radically reformed over the last decade. The FSA provides an interesting example. My own name was, so to speak, drawn out of a hat when I was appointed in 97. This was not a political appointment, though, as I'd been put into the hat by Gordon Brown's Conservative predecessor, who had named me as Deputy Governor of the Bank of England 2 years earlier. In the case of my successor, Callum McCarthy, by contrast, there was a public advertisement, a selection committee whose membership was publicly disclosed, a series of interviews, and a formal recommendation to the Chancellor, which he accepted. And similar procedures are now adopted for most, if not all, permanent secretary positions in Whitehall, and indeed for, I think, all other regulatory bodies and public authorities. That is not the case for senior appointments in the Bank of England and the Monetary Policy Committee. We know nothing of the processes which lead to those appointments. The same is broadly true in the US, but there the practice is not dissimilar from that adopted for other public appointments, which of course are frequently political in the way that they are not on this side of the Atlantic. And there is a formal confirmation process in which Bernanke is now currently engaged with every likelihood of success. So there is nothing unusual in Washington about the method of appointment of the chairman of the Fed, while there is nowadays in London in relation to the Bank of England and the MPC, even though, it must be said, the non-process last time produced absolutely the best qualified candidate in Mervyn King. At the ECB, we might say that there was a greater degree of transparency, in that we learnt a great deal about the political arguments leading to the appointment of the current president and indeed his predecessor. But these were political arguments, which seemed at the time to have little to do with the suitability of the individuals and more to do with their nationality. I've long been a great admirer of Jean-Claude Trichet, so I'm not making a personal point here. No one could deny that he was an outstanding candidate for the job. But can we imagine a situation in which future presidents of the ECB are always chosen in relation to their particular nationality on a Buggins turn basis? Would it not be preferable in future to adopt some kind of process to identify candidates who are technically suited to the task from whichever country they emerge? Perhaps a group of wise men and women could produce a slate of possibilities, leaving the final decision to the European Council. Whatever the precise methodology adopted, I hope we will see changes in the appointment procedures, both at the ECB and at the Bank of England, the next time round. Now, taken together, I think these four changes amount to a significant shift in the environment in which central banks operate. How, therefore, should they position themselves now to ensure that they learn the appropriate lessons and create the conditions in which they can do their job most effectively? And in asking these questions, I take it as axiomatic that we would wish central banks to be able to maintain their independence for key monetary policy decisions. The arguments in favour of such independence seem to me to be overpoweringly strong, and I don't propose to go into them in detail tonight. But we cannot take it for granted that independence will be maintained simply by asserting it. Central banks need to be conscious of the changing environment, to take account of political pressures, and to avoid, I would submit, overreaching themselves and claiming greater authority and competences than they can reasonably sustain. Now, in answering these questions, I find it hard to improve on the framework set out 5 years ago by Rick Mishkin in a paper published by the St. Louis Fed called What Should Central Banks Do? And Mishkin set out some guiding principles, such as that price stability provides substantial benefits to the economy, that monetary policy should be forward-looking, that policymakers should be accountable, etc. And from these guiding principles, he set out 7 recommendations for the future. And I think his framework remains valid, though in the light of recent experiences I've described, I interpret the practical implications of his framework rather differently, as I shall explain. Now, Mishkin's 7 criteria for a central bank began with the observations that price stability should be the overriding long-term goal of monetary policy, and an explicit nominal anchor should be adopted. And I'll say a little more about these first 2. He recognises that a number of different nominal anchors are possible, and the inflation target regime may not necessarily be the most appropriate for all countries, but he dismisses the argument that inflation targets necessarily result in too little emphasis on reducing output fluctuations. He maintains that inflation targeting, as it has actually been practiced, has been quite flexible. Indeed, adoption of an inflation target can actually make it easier for central banks to deal with negative shocks to the aggregate economy. Bernanke, the other day, took the same line before the Senate, arguing that publishing a long-run inflation target, quotes, would in no way reduce the importance of maximum employment as a policy goal. Indeed, a key justification of this action is its potential to contribute to stronger and more stable employment growth by further stabilizing inflation and inflation expectations. The record of countries which have adopted inflation targets over the last decade or more has been excellent. Sir Alan Budd, in his Wincott lecture last year, said, "It is universally acknowledged that the current framework for monetary policy is as close to perfection as fallible men can hope to achieve." Well, I think I would prefer to be slightly more cautious than that. And an article in the most recent Bank of England Quarterly Bulletin by Luca Bernati emphasises the benign political and economic conjuncture in which inflation targets have been introduced. And in a lecture here at the school last year, Norman Lamont, who was responsible really in a way for the implementation of this policy originally, reminded us that the introduction of an inflation target itself does not make any easier the key judgments which the monetary authority has to reach, and along with Sam Britton was sceptical about whether we had reached the end of monetary policy history. For the time being, however, I do not see any preferable framework on the horizon. Now, the arguments about goal and instrument independence are much more finely balanced, and I have outlined some of the points made on both sides already. In my view, the decisive arguments are political rather than economic. And to quote Mishkin again, basic democratic principles indicate that the preferences of policymaking should be outlined with the society at large. In the long run, a central bank cannot operate without the support of the public. If a central bank is seen to be pursuing goals which are not what the public wants, support for central bank independence is likely to erode. And I think this is a very important point. And since I believe the record has shown that independence is highly beneficial from the economic management point of view, we should seek structures of accountability which buttress that independence. How to create those structures is inevitably a matter of judgment. But my own assessment is that central banks are more vulnerable to political pressure when they appear to be, in some sense, excessively independent. Now, that threat perhaps can be offset by excellent performance over a period, and it's clear that Alan Greenspan is currently in that position. Also, he has been scrupulous in his dealings with Congress over a long period. But we do not normally design political structures which are only optimal if operated by heroes. We must also envisage the possibility of central bankers with feet of clay. For that reason, I think a framework along the lines of what we have in the UK, as borrowed from the All Blacks, is likely to prove more sustainable in the long run. There are more complex arguments related to the optimal time horizon for the inflation target. I do not see the logic of a target which applies to the whole of a governor's term without amendment, since one of the reasons for putting the responsibility for the target in the hands of the government is to admit the possibility that external circumstances might justify an upward shift in the inflation target, and that any temporary uplift should be administered explicitly rather than simply allowing the central bank to miss its target, albeit for good reasons. The credibility implications of missing a target are, in my view, worse than those of changing it in the long run. So while I favour the government setting inflation targets for a period ahead and see no strong case for an annual process, the adjustment of a target in the face of dramatic exogenous shocks should not be regarded as a wholly exceptional and untoward event. I think that these arguments are particularly important in relation to the ECB at the moment. And I think it is no accident that the ECB faces much more political pressure on interest rates than does the Bank of England, because there is no political framework within Europe in which finance ministers can argue about this. They have to do so in public speeches because they are not responsible for setting the inflation target. I think if they had to address themselves in the European Council, in the Council of Finance Ministers, to the question of whether they wanted to change the inflation target and allow the ECB more flexibility, I think they would find that a much more difficult argument to address. It's rather easier simply to pontificate about the need for the ECB to be more flexible. The accountability of the central bank is clearly vital and is related to the two previous points, but simply to say that it should be accountable, as Mishkin does, begs a number of questions. The existence of a nominal anchor under an inflation target facilitates accountability, since it's clear how the central bank's performance should ultimately be measured. And I think the provisions in the Bank of England Act for the governor to explain variations from the target are helpful. But there are other aspects of accountability too. And as I've suggested, I believe the position of a governor, a president, or a chairman is strengthened if he or she is seen to have emerged through an appointment process which incorporates appropriate checks and balances. That may include formal confirmation by the legislature, which is not currently a feature of the British system, even though the Treasury Select Committee sometimes behaves as if it is. The formal submission of testimony to Congress or Parliament also seems to me to be preferable to a system in which a parliamentary committee summons the governor when there happens to be time in their programme. The predictability of a report to elected representatives, which can be the occasion for others to comment on what it should contain and to offer an assessment of performance, seems to me to be consistent with the trend towards predictability and transparency, which has been widely beneficial in other respects. Now, Mishkin recognises that his sixth recommendation, that central banks should stress transparency in communication, is somewhat countercultural. As he says, although central bankers find their life to be a more comfortable one when they are not accountable and can avoid intense public scrutiny, increased transparency and accountability have important benefits. They can increase the public support for a price stability goal, can reduce political pressures on the central bank to pursue inflationary monetary policy, generating more support for forward-looking policy by the central bank. Also, greater transparency in communication can help the bank convince the public that fiscal policy needs to be aligned with monetary policy. Now, this latter point may not be entirely welcome to finance ministers, particularly in current circumstances in the US, the UK, and indeed the Eurozone. And central banks typically do not publish their recommendations on taxation and public spending, and in my view, they're wise to take that approach. Fun though it sometimes is to try to do the Chancellor's business for him instead of your own, there is a serious risk that the central bank will be seen to be exceeding its brief. That said, Mishkin's general point about communication must be correct, and I think in different ways the Fed, the ECB and the Bank of England have all made radical improvements in recent years, and others are beginning to copy them, though some are well behind. Central bank communication does, however, need to be more disciplined than is the case with many other public bodies. An excessive communication, particularly where subtly different formulations of policy are used, can confuse markets rather than influencing expectations helpfully. Some have argued that the existence of an explicit voting regime in the MPC may create the conditions in which communication becomes excessive. But in practice, I think, members have exercised considerable discretion in their public pronouncements, which has mitigated this risk to a great extent. In relation to both accountability and communication, the problems faced by the ECB and the Eurozone are of a particular kind. To state the obvious, the different members of the ECB are communicating in different countries against different political and economic backgrounds. As I've said, I think their task will be made easier by the existence of an inflation target regime, which would create stronger political commitment to the anti-inflation policy of the ECB than appears to exist in some governments today. And the ECB could then frame its own report of its performance against that background. In the long run, I think it will be necessary to reconsider the composition of the interest rate setting body in Europe. It's hard to imagine an effective council of 25, or perhaps 24, since I wouldn't wish to presume on the UK's position, plus six ECB members. It may be sensible to think of moving to a structure which looks more like that of the Bank of England, with a smaller monetary policy committee responsible for interest rate decisions, but accountable to a larger council, as the Monetary Policy Committee is to the Court of the Bank of England, for taking account of regional factors in its decision-making. At present, maybe the ECB is too new to envisage detaching it from its member state structure, but it's not too soon to open up the possibility of a different decision-making mechanism in the future. Now, Mishkin's last point is that central banks should also have a financial stability goal, and I've no difficulty with that recommendation at the highest level, but what does it imply? Mishkin himself tends to focus on the lender of last resort function and the provision of liquidity to the system in times of stress. Now, I regard that in principle as uncontroversial, though, of course, each individual case in which last resort lending is undertaken typically does generate massive controversy. And indeed, if and when such lending turns into solvency support, the finance ministry will very likely become involved. So the arrangements for last resort lending in the UK formally involve the Treasury and the supervisors as well as the Bank of England. But what does financial stability mean? And what other functions, if any, does a financial stability objective require a central bank to have? Now here, Mishkin hedges his bets. His own definition, published elsewhere, is the prevalence of a financial system which is able to ensure in a lasting way and without major disruptions an efficient allocation of savings to investment opportunities. He also tends to favour a supervisory role for the central bank in relation to banks, though he acknowledges that the argument for the central bank to have a role in prudential supervision is by no means clear-cut, and he recognises the risk that such involvement may cause a central bank to lose its focus on price stability. Now, it'll be apparent from what I said earlier that here I part company with him. I agree with Allen and Wood, who argue that the efficient allocation of savings to investments should not be part of a definition of financial stability. It's not in practice possible to observe whether this objective has been met until decades after the event, if even then. And a definition which is so vague can provide an excuse for a central bank to meddle in financial markets with potentially damaging consequences. I much prefer a narrower and more restrictive definition which focuses on the avoidance of episodes of instability where innocent bystanders get hurt. This much more restrictive approach pushes central banks back from the paterfamilias relationship they have had in the past. It reduces the risk of moral hazard and creates the conditions for a more level playing field between banks and other financial institutions with which they now often compete. If one adopts such a definition of financial stability and takes account of the changes in financial markets and the structure of financial institutions I've described, then a powerful case emerges for putting the responsibility for direct supervision elsewhere in another agency. Furthermore, there are important political and accountability arguments to buttress that conclusion. One doesn't need to go as far as Roger Douglas in New Zealand or Gordon Brown here and believe that every institution should have a single objective to see a strong argument for separating the price stability objective from the responsibility for supervising individual firms. It's not so much, I think, that central banks may be influenced in their monetary policy decisions by their views of the state of the banking system. That is sometimes asserted, but I have to say in my own practical experience, I did not find that to be the case. Indeed, central banks will have a view of the state of the banking system, or should have, whether or not they are a banking supervisor. But I think there is a risk of contagion from contested decisions and problems in financial supervision, and also a serious risk that the central bank may seem to be too powerful for its own good. As Dean and Pringle argue, central bankers keen to maintain monetary policy independence will think twice about seeking extra roles in the public domain, which can lead to accusations of being power hungry. The Bank of England have now fought off the BCCI challenge, and even when the case was continuing, it was well understood in the market that this related to the exercise of functions which the bank no longer held, and therefore the reputational risk to its monetary policy was minimal. But the risk is nonetheless clear, and the continued difficulties in banking supervision from Johnson Matthey through BCCI to Barings had an impact on politicians' views of the possibility of giving the bank independence for monetary policy purposes. One might similarly ask whether in Italy, if the Bank of Italy was still the monetary authority, the recent difficulties experienced by Governor Fazio wouldn't have had very severe consequences for confidence and credibility of monetary policy. Only the fact that the views of the governor are no longer of any great significance in relation to economic policy in Italy has prevented the Anton Veneta affair from becoming a major crisis. Also, and I think this is perhaps the most important point, even though I sometimes regretted the fact when I chaired the FSA, a different kind of accountability is necessary in relation to a financial supervisor which exercises disciplinary powers and determines the allocation of property rights. Such an authority needs more direct accountability to Parliament of a rather different kind from that of an independent monetary authority. It has to have legal constraints imposed on it, including the possibility of judicial review and appeal against its judgments to the courts. That kind of architecture of accountability and control is not suitable to a central bank with monetary functions. And a central bank which finds itself embroiled in that kind of political and legal controversy will find it difficult to insulate its monetary policy decisions. So, if we wish to preserve central bank independence in the exercise of the monetary policy instrument, as I certainly do, then I think it is unwise to give it additional functions where different types of accountability are necessary. In their review of central banks and financial stability, Oosterloo and Dehaene conclude the democratic accountability of the financial stability function of central banks is often poorly arranged, and that, I think, is a danger sign. So I would add an eighth recommendation to the seven Mishkin, Governor Fazio was supposed to emerge in that discussion somewhere. I would add an eighth recommendation to the seven Mishkin points. It is that central banks who wish to maintain their independence of monetary policy should either give up or not seek responsibilities which require different forms of accountability and political dependence. It is perfectly possible to establish other types of authority which are well able to carry out the grubby business of institutional supervision, and it's perfectly possible to devise lines of communication between those authorities and central banks, which are needed to give the central bank access to the information it needs for its monetary and financial stability objectives. Those structures are proving themselves to be robust in a number of countries, and the central banks who got used to them are, as far as I'm aware, typically relieved to be allowed to focus on their core business. Once relieved of frontline institutional responsibilities, central banks can and should find a new financial stability role complementary to the one exercised by the supervisor. They can afford, without direct disciplinary and enforcement powers, to focus on market trends and systemic issues, leaving compliance to others. This is not a residual role, it is a vital one. There are crucial systemic issues related to the payments, clearing, and settlement systems which central banks are best placed to address. But it does not require a small army of quasi-regulators second-guessing the competent supervisory authorities. The need is for a small team as close to the markets as possible, looking for potential trouble. The old Bank of England division in charge of banks was called Supervision and Surveillance. The two S's have now been separated, with supervision in the FSA and surveillance in the Bank of England. Perhaps the fact that the two words are indistinguishable in French, and the French used to call the division surveillance et surveillance, because there are no two words in French which capture this thought, prevents some continental central banks from reaching the same sensible conclusion. The problems of the Eurozone national central banks are indeed the least tractable, and not only for linguistic reasons. What is a central bank without monetary or supervision responsibilities? Are the gilded halls and the claret or the Barolo all that remains? Well, certainly a national central bank in the Eurozone should be a smaller institution. Both the Bank of France and the Bundesbank employ around 8 times as many people as the Bank of England, which is hard to explain. But their governors need briefing for their trips to Frankfurt, and there is an important role in analysing the domestic economy, and will be for some time. And there's also a new financial stability function to be defined if past traditions can be forgotten, though traditions die hard in central banking. There is sadly little sign of this redefinition occurring, even though the critics of this failure to adapt to EMU are becoming more strident. In the New York Times last Sunday, Professor Alan Blinder of Princeton, sometime vice chairman of the Fed, noted that Ben Bernanke's appointment was generating little controversy in Washington. This may in part be because the president has nominated a candidate whose expertise is not in question. But Blinder suggests that another factor is at work. The happy truth, he said, is that monetary policy is not very controversial and certainly not very political these days. Instead, there is a strong intellectual and political consensus that the central bank should be free of political interference, should keep inflation low, and should promote high employment. Furthermore, while central banking remains part art, part science, the science has clearly been gaining on the art in recent decades. Central bankers around the world are increasingly thought of as technocrats, not as philosopher kings or sorcerers. I suspect that this is what Mervyn King meant when he set out his objective. He wants central banking to be boring in the Alan Blinder rather than the David O'Leary sense. A boring central bank should set out its intentions clearly within a framework set by government with clear accountability. It should act predictably with as much transparency as possible. It should eschew other entanglements, especially those like institutional supervision, which carry reputational risks and require different forms of political control. Its obvious commitment to efficiency and cost effectiveness will insulate it from public and political criticism. Its financial stability commitment will be clearly and tightly defined, buttressed by an intimate relationship with the regulator. It will look, in other words, rather like the Bank of England does today. Thank you.
The slides and the transcript of the paper will be available on the web tomorrow for those who would like to have a copy. We do have some time for questions and answers. Could people who want to ask a question please identify themselves by name and institution? Are there any questions? Bill Allen.
Bill Allen from Cass Business School. I'd like to ask you to talk a bit more about your views on accountability in respect of monetary policy. I mean, the main kind of channels of accountability are that central bankers publish material explaining what they've done and answer questions from parliamentary committees. And generally, that just requires them to explain the reasons that they had for the decisions they took. If there are difficult questions, on the whole, they're able to dazzle the audience with their technical expertise, which they can provide with the help of their quite large staffs. But the bottom line is that they can't be fired because they're independent and security of tenure is part of independence. That being so, how real can the accountability actually be?
Well, I think that the framework that was set out in the UK is, in my view, pretty good. Though I have suggested at least one way in which I think it could be improved, and that is in the appointment process. And I think that in the long run, the governors and members of the MPC should find it helpful to them in terms of their position if they have emerged through some process which matches best practice in other appointments. And I think at the moment the lack of that is a potential weakness in our system. But otherwise, it's hard to think of many great improvements to a regime which requires you to set out, well, gives you a clear target of what you're supposed to achieve, requires you to explain how you plan to achieve it looking forward, and also requires you to explain explicitly why, if you have strayed from the desired path, that has happened. Now, I guess it's fair to say that we don't really know what the political and popular reaction would be in the event of the Bank of England straying significantly from the target path and not having a particularly good explanation for it, except that it screwed up. I mean, I'd imagine that if the oil price if there'd been more of a pass-through of the current oil price rise than there has been, and indeed some of us slightly mystified as to why there hasn't been more, but if there had been more, and I think the Bank of England had to write a letter and had explained, well, you know, when we started this year, the oil price was $30 and it's now 65, I could imagine that people would say, well, there you go, and they would probably accept that. If, however, the bank had to write a letter where there was no obvious exogenous reason or economic development which had created a price shock, then it would be more difficult. But at least I think there is a framework within which that argument could be had, and the bank would be required to set out its reasoning as to why it had not made different judgments and why it had strayed from the target path. So I'm not sure that, to say, apart from the appointments process, I could think of an obviously better framework than the one we currently have, although we don't precisely know how it will operate in practice yet. It's surprising that we don't, but we don't.
I can never understand why we don't use the price mechanism and award members of the MPC depending on how close they get to 2.5. But let that be.
You don't have a personal interest for arguing that, do you, Charles?
I did once. Next question, please.
Thank you. I hope my question is appropriate. You were talking about the role of financial stability in...
Name and institution, please.
I'm sorry?
Name and institution.
I am a student at London School of Economics. I was wondering if you could... I would be very interested in knowing your opinion and of the idea of international clearinghouse.
Sorry, in what context? I mean,
in the context of providing a very good financial stability of capital markets.
An international clearinghouse across different stock exchanges, or...
Yes. I hope it's appropriate. It is more of a radical concept out there.
Yeah, no, I understand what you mean. I think that the arguments for clearing from the trading platform, I think, are quite powerful, but I think that they are largely competition arguments rather than financial stability arguments. So I think that there's quite a strong argument for the clearing function to be a quasi-utility, and therefore the underpinning of potentially competing trading platforms. There is a kind of argument for saying that a clearing function and and perhaps a central counterparty, which might be a link to it in another way, could assist. But I'm not sure that the financial stability argument is particularly robust there. I think that if you had a complete gumming up of stock market trading, the likely reason would be to do with liquidity problems in the participants in that market, and that you would probably deal with that via liquidity assistance to the major players and the major counterparties in the system, rather than supplying money through a clearinghouse, because I just don't think that would be a very effective way of ungumming the system. So I'm not personally sure. I think the competition arguments are reasonably powerful. I think the financial stability arguments are not particularly strong.
There's a question right at the back there.
Hello. I'm Sean, and I'm a student at the LSE. Just to comment on the criticism about the bank, there's some people have said that perhaps it's slightly strange that the bank is the body which measures inflation as well as sets the target. So it sets the target and tells people that it meets it. So that could be a possible criticism, but that's not really my question. I'm just interested to know what your opinion is about exchange rate policy, because you seem to propose inflation targeting as the way to go with monetary policy, except exchange rates are an important monetary consideration for a lot of countries, for example, in Asia, China especially at the moment.
Yeah. On the first point, what I was arguing was, precisely to meet your point, that I think that it is better if you have an inflation target regime if you have somebody else set the target, which the bank then meets. So I believe I favour target dependence in the jargon and instrument independence. As far as what inflation actually is, I mean, typically central banks don't typically measure that. I mean, they are given, and certainly in this country, the Bank of England is given a definition of price of inflation that it is to use by the government, and that is measured elsewhere, is measured by the Central Statistical Office and not by the Bank of England itself. So we do deal with that that problem. Certainly it wouldn't be a good idea if the central bank were responsible for setting the target, meeting the target, and indeed measuring whether, you know, what inflation was. I certainly think that would be a flawed reason. Now, I guess my focus was primarily on the US, the Eurozone, and the Bank of England. And I think that, as Mishkin argues, that a central bank should have a nominal anchor. And it is clearly possible for that nominal anchor instead to be a fixed exchange rate. And there are clearly examples. Hong Kong is the most obvious one, which have been successful in using an anchor for anti-inflation policy as the, you know, a fixed exchange rate for some other countries. Now, I think that the conventional wisdom, which I guess I would share, is that, you know, you can either have a really fixed exchange rate or nothing very much, and that all the sort of intermediate regimes have proved to be extremely difficult. And if you have the credibility to operate a fixed exchange rate, and that probably means keeping a rather a large pool of reserves in order to buttress your credibility in the marketplace, then that can clearly work. I do not think that it is an easy option for a large economy, for the reasons of that we've observed of the difficulty of sustaining fixed exchange rate regimes. But it clearly does meet the Mishkin first criterion of a clear nominal anchor. I mean, you have to accept, of course, in those circumstances, that you are vulnerable to the monetary policy decisions taken by other countries. And some circumstances, like the Argentina case, you know, a fixed exchange rate proved unsustainable, partly because of what was actually happening to the dollar, and that wasn't a very suitable currency for them to be related to. So it's a risky strategy, I would say, but clearly one that can work, and there are circumstances like Hong Kong which have shown it for some years.
Well, we're getting on in time, and I think we really ought to draw this to a close, and let me end by saying that that was an absolutely splendid lecture. I don't need to work to do any more work as a monetary economist. Anyhow, thank you very, very much indeed, and let us show our gratitude in a normal way. Thank you very much.